This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we mark the anniversary of Russia's unlawful invasion of Ukraine. 1 year ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin launched a war on this sovereign, independent nation whose trajectory toward greater democracy and freedom he could not tolerate. He thought he would overwhelm and conquer Kyiv and send the young newly elected Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky packing. He thought he could divide the West and continue the onslaught that began in 2014 when Moscow illegally annexed Crimea and the Donbas region with impunity. In fact, the opposite occurred. 1 year later, Kyiv stands, and Ukraine is unified in repelling the Russian attack. And Russia is struggling, having had to call up hundreds of thousands of reservists in what was supposed to be a short and decisive military operation. Putin has taken to nuclear saber-rattling. He has announced suspension of Moscow's participation in the last remaining U.S.-Russia nuclear arms control treaty known as New START, and the West is more united than ever. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. As U.S. President Joe Biden said on his surprise visit to Kyiv on February 20, quote, "When Putin launched his invasion nearly 1 year ago, he thought Ukraine was weak and the West was divided. He thought he could outlast us, but he was dead wrong." President Biden went on to say that, quote, "Over the last year, the United States has built a coalition of nations from the Atlantic to the Pacific to help defend Ukraine with unprecedented military, economic, and humanitarian support, and that support will endure," unquote. Biden's visit to a war zone was unprecedented, and it demonstrated his undying support for Ukraine's territorial integrity. President Biden is credited with rallying NATO, the EU, and other pro-Western partners in defending Ukraine against Russia's illegal attempt to conquer a sovereign nation. To take stock of this sobering anniversary, we turn to two distinguished regional experts. Andrea Kendall-Taylor is Senior Fellow and Director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and that's a policy group based in Washington. And Will Pomerantz, he is Director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, a think tank also based in Washington. And both panelists join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Carol.
My pleasure.
Let me begin with you, Andrea Kendall-Taylor, to get your overall assessment of the conflict as we mark this anniversary of the horrific invasion.
Well, I think you covered a lot of it, Carol, and that is the idea that this really has already been a strategic failure for Russia. As you mentioned, Putin thought he was going to get to Kyiv in 3 days, topple the Zelensky government, and the rest of the country would kind of fall like a house of cards into place in a more subservient way to Moscow. And that clearly has not been what's happened. But bringing us to the present, if you look at the battlefield, it's looking increasingly likely that we are headed towards a protracted conflict in Ukraine. The Russians aren't making any progress. You know, we've all been waiting for what has been billed as a major Russian offensive in the coming weeks or months. Many Russian military analysts believe that offensive may already be underway, and the Russians are failing to make any progress. So really, this reality is setting in here in Washington and in European capitals, and I think in Moscow as well, that we're headed towards a very prolonged war. And I think that was the backdrop of a flurry of activity this week. President Putin gave his speech to Parliament. President Biden, as you mentioned, made an unprecedented trip to Kyiv and a historical and momentous speech in Warsaw. And so in many ways, it was like a dueling attempt to signal the staying power and resolve of both sides. So President Putin is not going to stop fighting until he believes that time is on Ukraine's side. And so President Biden was doing his best to convince him that the United States is in this for the long term. And, you know, he used that phrase, "the United States will not tire." And so I think that's where we are, is both sides staring into this eventuality that this could continue for a long time and figuring out how they will be able to sustain the effort over the long term.
Turning to you, Will Pomerantz, for your reflections about the year, the invasion, the aftermath, as we mark this anniversary.
I think that both parties don't have any wiggle room or really kind of negotiating stance to end this war. Putin can't back down because he has made this a fundamental part of his policy and indeed the defining moment of his presidency. Zelensky can't back down because he has presided over a very successful military campaign, but he also rejected initial negotiations, and now he can't kind of negotiate away the sacrifice of the Ukrainian people, and they have sacrificed so much during this 1 year. So it is going to be a protracted war. The major issue is trying to see which side blinks first, and I don't really have a prediction on that, but I think it will be on the battlefield. And it will basically be what side can maintain its current troop levels and what side can actually have a breakthrough during this war.
Well, turning back to you, Andrea, about what it will take for Ukraine to eventually prevail, whatever that means. Of course, a lot of people talk about, you know, how is this going to end? What is it going to look like? I usually refrain from asking these questions because this whole conflict is unpredictable in many ways. And yet, as you said, the West is together for now. Do you see any potential cracks in this extraordinary alliance? How do you see the alliance holding together and continuing to support Ukraine in terms of the kinds of weaponry it needs and humanitarian and economic support?
I think so far, so good. I mean, obviously, when you have a coalition of this size with all of the countries, United States, Canada, all of the European NATO nations, getting to consensus and maintaining cohesion is hard. But the allies, I think, have far surpassed what many of us expected going into this war. The unity and cohesion has really been remarkable. And when you talk about the strategic failure for Putin, the way that it has catalyzed this extent of cohesion and unity, I think, is another reason why this has been such a catastrophic failure for Putin. I mean, just recognizing that NATO itself is expanding, hopefully adding Finland and Sweden in the coming months. We know the European Union is working on a 10th sanctions package. So the allies have come together to put remarkable pressure on Putin, trying to constrict and constrain the Russian economy, making it more difficult for Putin to be able to sustain the war. We can see that the allies continue to come together to sustain the military support that Ukraine needs on the battlefield. And we've seen that the types of weapon systems have gradually moved up in terms of their sophistication. You know, if you think back to the beginning of the war, it was very provocative to think that we would be giving javelins or HIMARS to Ukraine, but all of those have been provided. And now we're on to talking about that we've promised the Abrams tanks and the Leopard tanks. And now the allies are talking about fighter jets. And so together we're moving along to try to do what it takes to sustain Ukraine's effort. But there's still a long way to go. And I think that's where the allies are now, is thinking about things like ammunition. Ukraine is firing more ammunition than the West is able to provide. More ammo, more air defense. We need to keep providing more advanced systems, moving from the HIMARS perhaps to this system called ATACMS, which would give Ukraine even more range and allow them to hold more Russian targets at risk. We need more sanctions. We need to tighten the existing sanctions. We need to work together to bring the rest of the world along. I know that the United States and Europe like to pat themselves on the back talking about the coalition that we put together, but the reality is that there are many countries, India, South Africa, Saudi Arabia, but all across the globe who are not a part of this coalition pressuring Russia to end the war. And so the United States and Europe also need to work more on building a more muscular coalition to push back on Russia. So for now, the unity and the effort has been tremendous, but there is still a long way to go.
Still a long way to go, Will Pomerantz. Interestingly, President Biden coined the phrase the NATOization of Finland, right? Because Finland and Sweden are set to join NATO, adding to the strength of the coalition. On the other hand, you're more of a skeptic, and you know that Putin has his own allies. We are witnessing, of course, this week, China's top diplomat visited Moscow. And of course, Secretary of State Antony Blinken is warning China not to provide weapons to Russia. So talk about anything you would like to add to what Andrea said with regard to the coalition of Western nations, but also the types of support that Putin is trying to rally on his side.
To add to what Andrea said, so far, so good. And I think one of the reasons why the Western alliance has held together is that Putin is waging an imperial war. And we all thought that the age of empire ended after the end of World War I and World War II. But for Putin, this is a fight for adding territory to the Russian Federation. Indeed, one of the first things he did after he attacked Ukraine was to change the Russian constitution and add the four regions, Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson, to the Russian constitution as constituent parts of the federation. So Putin has gone out on a limb and has really gone kind of as a throwback to the 18th century, fighting an imperial war at a time when we thought the age of imperialism was long relegated to the history book. So I think that one of the reasons why the West will hold is that if they want to have a rules-based order and they want to protect the sovereignty of other nations, both large and small, that they can't acquiesce to what Russia has done. In terms of the other aspect of this war and when it will end, I think it's important to note that even if the events on the battlefield lead to a conclusion, this war will not end because Russia will have to be held accountable for the war crimes that they have committed in Ukraine. And there's a lot of discussion as to how that can happen, what sort of international tribunal can be established. But there is no doubt that the United States and the Europeans want to hold Russia accountable for the war crimes. Finally, you talked about Putin's allies. Lavrov went on a trip to Africa. I don't think he collected a lot of new allies on that trip. When Putin talks about the positive aspects of the Russian economy, he noted that trade with Belarus has increased dramatically. And I don't think Belarus is really the type of country that Putin is looking for to defend and to help Russia in this crisis.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Andrea Kendall-Taylor, Senior Fellow and Director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Will Pomerantz, from whom you just heard. He's Director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center, also based in Washington. We are discussing the state of play in Ukraine on the anniversary of Russia's brutal and unlawful invasion of that sovereign country. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on most of your favorite podcast apps, or you can download the show at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Anderson Alves from São Paulo, Brazil. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an old-fashioned email to encounter@voanews.com, or you can like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion about Russia's invasion of Ukraine 1 year later. So, Andrea Kendall-Taylor, I want to continue just a bit about the role of China. How do you see it evolving with regard to its alliance with Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine? Do you see greater support? Do you think they will pull the trigger, so to speak, with regard to any military support? What would be the repercussions of that?
It's a very good question. Certainly, Russia is working to mobilize its partners just as the United States is. And I think there's been a lot of debate about the nature of the Russia-China relationship, with some wondering whether or not Xi is trying to back away from Putin given how horribly they've performed. But I think, you know, looking at this trip of Wang Yi, as you said, China's top diplomat in Russia, met with Putin this week. And I think we have to be clear about the timing of this meeting. It was obviously coordinated to correspond with the one-year anniversary, and I think really allows Putin to demonstrate to his domestic audience and to other countries that Russia is not as isolated as we would have hoped after 1 year of this war. And from Beijing's perspective, I think that they are still firmly committed to the partnership with Russia, because Russia is a critical partner for Beijing in its increased confrontation with the West. And so China has no interest in seeing Putin fail in this war, and certainly no interest in seeing Putin being destabilized domestically because of this war. And so it is my view that China still is very much all in. They are in Russia's corner. And while Beijing won't do anything to elicit unnecessary blowback for its support, I think they will do everything possible right up to that line. And we should be clear, too, that Beijing has been a really critical lifeline for Russia throughout this first year of the war. Diplomatically, Beijing has parroted many of Russia's talking points about the war, blaming NATO and its expansion for provoking the Russian invasion. And certainly economically, China is buying up Russian oil and gas. They're selling microchips and other advanced technologies that have military uses. And all of these things are helping to mitigate Western pressure. So it is a very important partnership for Russia, and as you noted, the United States warning very vocally that China may be considering providing military support, that would be a major step. And so the question is, what can the West do about it? Well, I think that's one of the primary reasons that Secretary of State Anthony Blinken wanted to meet with Wang Yi at the Munich Security Conference last week, and to be able to communicate that there would be costs if China crosses this red line. I am sure Washington is working up potential responses, primarily economic, to really ensure that China would face costs for taking that type of action. But I think one of the most important responses would have to come from Europe, too, because China, they want to make sure that Europe sits on the fence between the United States and China and doesn't side entirely with the United States in the confrontation with Beijing. And so if European leaders can communicate that there would be costs, I think that perhaps would be the most effective effort to try to deter Beijing from taking that step.
Will Pomerantz, I'd like to get your take on Beijing vis-a-vis Russia. As we've said, the U.S. is very concerned that Beijing may be considering supplying weapons to Russia. As Andrea Kendall-Taylor said, they're all in so far in other aspects, buying up oil and gas, providing chips and so forth. Do you think the United States and Europe will be able to impose costs that will be too high for Beijing to take that step that could transform the war into a confrontation between Russia and China on the one side and Ukraine and NATO on the other?
I think the United States is not looking to bring China into this war, and we're not interested in leading to World War III, as it were, with two strong blocks of nuclear powers going against each other. So I think Andrea really identified all the issues for China and the United States and whether China will actually become a party of this conflict. The only words of optimism is that I don't know to what extent China wants to be engaged and be the backer of Russia. China does not have a high view of Russia in terms of its recent history. Indeed, in China, what they study is the collapse of the Soviet Union so that they don't follow the Russian and Soviet example of trying to produce too many reforms too fast. So there is always the risk that China does become involved. That will be a game changer if it does. And if China decides to break sanctions and to supply Russia with arms, I would expect a very vigorous response from the West, as Secretary of State Blinken alluded to during the Munich conference.
Turning back to you, Andrea Kendall-Taylor, to look at the so-called nuclear saber rattling, we note this week that Vladimir Putin delivered a warning to the West over Ukraine by suspending the landmark nuclear arms control treaty, the New START treaty. What does the suspension of Moscow's participation in that signal, in your view, at this juncture?
Well, first, we should recognize that the treaty was already in trouble. So the Biden administration had said last month that Russia was not in compliance with the agreement because they were refusing to allow on-site inspections. I think it's really important that we avoid overreacting. Putin suspended Russia's participation in the treaty. He didn't withdraw, which means they could return to it in the future. And it seems to me still very unlikely that this will open up an arms race between the two countries. I mean, I think Russian officials were even out making statements after Putin's speech that they don't intend to exceed the numeric threshold on nuclear weapons that is imposed by New START. But there are consequences. I mean, it does make it more difficult for the United States to gain insights into Russia's nuclear program and vice versa. Of course, the United States has other methods, our own intelligence, satellites, and other means of gleaning some of those insights. But the fact that we will no longer be having those on-site inspections, and especially if the notifications were to end, if the notification system were to end. Basically, it makes it harder for each side to understand what's happening with those nuclear weapons, and that can breed a lot of mistrust that creates a problematic situation for both sides. So in my mind, this is consistent with Putin's nuclear saber rattling. I think he's looking to use his nuclear bullying to stoke fear and division between the United States and our allies and partners. I think probably the worst news of this is that it does portend poorly for the future of arms control. This treaty is set to expire in 2026, and the fact that Russia has suspended its participation, I think makes it unlikely or ever more difficult for us to find a new replacement agreement to follow on. So that's the bad news.
Will Pomerantz, what's your reaction to Putin's suspension of participation in the New START treaty?
Again, Andrea has outlined what the potential ramifications are. I want to go back to the discussion as to Russia's capabilities in the aftermath of 1 year of war and 1 year of sanctions, because there have been attempts to skirt sanctions, and they have been fairly successful. But the Russian economy, after 1 year of sanctions, has been really diminished because of the attempt to limit trade and access to Western finance to the Russian Federation. And I think that we need to emphasize that these sanctions and these measures are actually having an impact, whether it be Russia's decision not to abide by the European Court of Human Rights or its exclusion from the Council of Europe. But also, there is now evidence that these sanctions are producing significant shortages in Russia, whether it be in medicines, whether it be in production capabilities, and whether it be in chip manufacturing and so forth. So I think that the other factor that we need to be considering is the sanctions are not a panacea, and they don't change the calculus overnight. Clearly, they have not led to a decision by Vladimir Putin not to end the invasion of Ukraine. But I think that in the medium term, these sanctions are going to have an impact on the Russian economy. And I think that that is something that we will have to monitor to see to what extent they are having an impact and whether they actually lead to social and political challenges.
That's a very interesting point, Will Pomerantz. I'd like to talk to you about that, Andrea Kendall-Taylor. As Will said, the sanctions are not a panacea. They do not have an impact overnight. But as Will said, they seem to be diminishing the Russian economy. What is your take on the impact of the sanctions over time? And do you think that there will be political will to maintain these sanctions, increase them if necessary, and get more players on board?
I agree with Will that it is having an impact. I think the impact isn't as great as we would have hoped. And so Russia's economy shrunk by something around 2%, and it may even return to growth next year. And so to me, that underscores that we still have more to do on the sanctions front. It's not just the impact of sanctions diminishing the Russian economy, but as Will pointed out, the export controls, disrupting supply lines and things that Russia needs in order to maintain the production of the weapons that it's using on the battlefield. The problem is that Russia is looking for workarounds. You know, you could have illicit networks and use other ways to evade the sanctions and export controls. And so where we need to go in the future is, of course, continuing to increase the sanctions, going after additional individuals, additional sectors of the Russian economy. But we also need to tighten up the existing sanctions and tighten up those export controls to make it ever more difficult for Russia to evade those sanctions. I think the one big step that the West is contemplating, and I hope they will take, is going after the frozen central bank assets. Hundreds of billions of dollars are sitting there frozen in many Western bank accounts. And so now the United States, Europe, and other G7 countries are looking for a legal pathway to be able to confiscate those assets and use them for the rebuilding of Ukraine. And that would be a really important step to take. And I hope that's something that we move towards in this second year of the war.
Will Pomerantz, you get the last word.
Clearly, some countries don't want to raid the foreign accounts of the Russian Federation. But I think that that is in the cards, because some sort of reparations will have to be made to Ukraine. Something will have to be done to rebuild Ukraine. And Russia will have to be responsible for making some of these payments as well. So I think the frozen reserves of the Russian Federation and Western banks are on the table. And in light of all the destruction that has occurred in Ukraine, that is one of the places that the West will look to help rebuild and reconstruct Ukraine. There have been several major changes in global trade as a result of this war. And the one thing I want to emphasize is that the permanent normal trade relations that both the EU and the United States had with Russia, that took a long time to implement and to introduce, have now all been revoked. So even after the war, however it ends, a lot of things are in place now that will make it very difficult for Russia to reintegrate into the global economy.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this special edition of Encounter, marking the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. I'd like to thank my guests, Andrea Kendall-Taylor, Senior Fellow and Director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Will Pomerantz. He's Director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.